beautiful King James Version will be helpful. In 1604, King James I commissioned a new English-language Bible for the Church of England, translated from Hebrew, Greek, and a touch of Latin by 46 clergymen and one eminent Greek scholar. It rapidly became the dominant translation. Here is its rendering of Matthew chapter 5, verse 6. "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled." This line is lousy with poetry. It conveys authority and inspires awe. How? Well, it starts with an inversion. "Blessed are they," instead of "they are blessed." This word order is archaic and literary, even in 1604. In other words, this isn't the way an average Londoner talked. Next, we get the delicate phrasing of "they which" and the elaborated verb form "do hunger." Why these choices? For one, they fit the meter. Oh yes, the first clause is written in an ancient poetic meter called dactylic pentameter. If that isn't fancy enough, we get "after" instead of a more common "for," a choice that suggests striving and effort. Plus, it too fits the meter. So what is all this high-flown language meant to accomplish? Simple. To make you believe. To make a Christian out of those who aren't, and better Christians out of those who are. The translators created a Bible so sublimely beautiful, so removed from the world, that it could be easily accepted as the Word of God. They set out to do something, and they did it smashingly. For the epigraphs to the chapters of Life in Year One, I've translated some very familiar Greek passages from the New Testament. All except the one heading the epilogue came from the mouth of Jesus. Here, for example, is my version of that famous line from Matthew. "Those who hunger and thirst for justice are blessed, since they will feast." It has none of the heightened poetry, no meter, no delicate phrasing, no inversion. So what am I trying to do? Again, the answer is simple. To put you there, on the street, at the time the words were spoken. As much as possible, and that is a huge qualifier, I have tried to recreate each line in its context. To do this, I've used a kind of informed imagining, gathering together everything I can know about the language, the historical setting, and the immediate circumstances, and then wading into that stream of choices. So for this line, imagine with me. Jesus is on a hill, speaking to a crowd made up of people from all over Judea, Galilee, Jerusalem, and across the Jordan River. He isn't speaking in his first language, Aramaic. He talks in Koine Greek, a lingua franca, in order to be understood by Jews and Gentiles alike. His is a spoken language, a trade language, somewhat akin to Swahili in Eastern Africa now, but still, Koine is degenerated from classical and Hellenistic Greek and has tremendous flexibility and force. With its philosophical and literary ancestry, it is a language with a diverse vocabulary, and yet the syntax has been ground down to bare essentials over the centuries of use across the Mediterranean, in marketplaces, courts, and army camps, by non-native speakers. This is the language of the Gospels, full of simple phrases with blunt edges. Consider the class and minimal education of Jesus, his followers, and their audience, then ask, what is Jesus trying to accomplish in these difficult circumstances? To be poetic or to be understood? Patrick Stayer. Author's introductory note on writing Life in Year One. Beware of those scholars aching to strut around in gaudy robes, who love formal greetings in the markets, prime seats in synagogues, and places of honor at meals. Luke chapter 20, verse 46. Listen to me, all of you, and pay attention. Mark chapter 7, verse 14. What goes into the mouth does not corrupt a man, but what comes from the mouth, this corrupts a man. Matthew chapter 15, verse 11. The three quotations previously listed, all fairly familiar, I think, and all from Jesus, are ones I tried to keep in mind as I wrote this book. The first, about strutting.